Kareem Ray, your host at the One Soccer Nation panel discussion today. The topic of discussion is what makes investing in pro soccer so appealing to investors. We have great people on with us today who are within different spaces within the beautiful game that bring us all together. I would like to thank everyone for taking the time today. We have Darren Van Tassel, Ira Jersey, and Stephen Powell on with us today. We'll start off with Darren for an intro, please.
Well, thanks for having us. My official title is the president and co-owner of South Georgia Tormenta FC. We have clubs that play in USL League One, USLW, the USL Academy, and then we have a fairly large academy and recreation program under that. So happy to be on today.
Thank you, Darren. We also have Ira Jersey on with us.
Yeah, thanks, Graham. Great to be here. So I'm Ira Jersey, co-founder and men's general manager for Real Central New Jersey Soccer in obviously Central New Jersey near Princeton and Trenton. We're an aspiring USL League One and USL Super League club looking for investment here in Central Jersey. We currently play in USL League Two, the Women's Premier Soccer League, and also this year are joining the USL Academy League now that there's a Mid-Atlantic division. So, expanding within the USL infrastructure.
Thank you, Ira. And we also have Stephen Powell.
Yeah, hi there, Kareem. Again, echoing what Darren had just said, thank you very much for the invitation to participate today. I'm a VP of business development for an agency called For Soccer. We're a soccer marketing, media, and experiences company. And we work with brands and fans and players with soccer communities across the entire country. It's funny because someone asked me this question yesterday. I never really thought about it. Over three decades, I've worked for eight different clubs, an agency, and a league office. So I've been lucky enough to work with lots of very talented men and women, learn a lot along the way. I feel really, really good about where our game is now too, which I guess that's the best part of it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Stephen. So, I'll just go back to, what I said earlier about what makes investing in US pro soccer so appealing. Darren, I'll start with you. I remember our interview and you really mentioned soccer was brought up to you. What was it for you that said, okay, let's invest in pro soccer in the U.S.?
Listen, my own background is in international sport for a long time, pre-Olympics in baseball, World Cups in baseball. And for 25 years, I was either a coach or a player or working on the International Baseball Federation. And because every sport has its own federation, in our world here for our conversations today, we all live under the umbrella of FIFA, but every sport has one. Here's what I was observing during that 20 plus years in almost 50 countries. And it's that soccer and football weren't just the biggest sport in the world. They were the biggest anything in the world. And when you pair that with the reality of, listen, I don't think some countries are more sports crazed than others or cultures, but certainly the United States is one of them. A lot of wealth, of course, and a lot of high-end sports. But because in our country that Major League Baseball is a private entity, the NBA is private, the NFL is private, the idea of an international sport federation is really not very well known to people in the United States, quite frankly, but FIFA is. But because the big sports in our country and in my life were really handed down to me, I learned baseball from my father and grandfather and basketball and football, became a sports fan. I liked it because they liked it. And then we obviously internalize it and become our own. Soccer was handed up, though. I didn't learn soccer organically from anybody older than me. I learned it because my son was playing. And it was an entirely different experience. And I think for my generation and a whole generation of us, we learned it that way. It won't always be that way. But right now, think about this on the business model. You have the biggest anything in the world, give me some latitude, in one of the most wealthiest sport countries in the world. Just as a side note, nobody else has colleges and universities that play sport like this country does, much less the number of athletes that are playing. And you marry all that with a sport that's moving this direction. Now, at some point, people like my child, and who's now a young man, and you know, they'll be our ages and older, and it'll start spilling back down. We're on a once-in-a-lifetime runway in terms of that, because that won't be the case at some point. It's come for a lot of work, People far older than I am who were got into this game when it wasn't the most sexy thing to do, and it certainly was just a love for the game that was driving it. Well, that love for the game has not changed. I certainly hope it hasn't. Not for me. It's new still for me. But there is an investment business piece to it now that as we marry the two, I think that's really important. So I think that's part of how I answer that question of why soccer, why now?
Understood. Thank you, Darren. What about for you, Ira?
So I think there's a number of different pieces to why soccer is an interesting investment opportunity today versus, say, even 25, 30 years ago when Major League Soccer started after NASL fell. So my backstory is that I started playing soccer when I was 5 years old in 1975. I really fell in love with it when I saw Pele play for the Cosmos. He came to my local club. They were very accessible. Like, the fact that Franz Beckenbauer was there too was kind of like a side note, but everyone remembered seeing Pele, you know, the biggest global sports star, like Darren just mentioned, in the world, coming off of, you know, his amazing career. We were the first kind of generation, I think, in mass to start playing soccer. And now that we're, you know, there's still a lot of people like Darren who are learning it from the bottom up, you know, the kids play and it goes up. But my kids all played soccer at some point. Two of them still are involved with the sport, even though, you know, one's in college and the other one's just about to start high school. It's just a growing community around the sport from people here. Not to mention the fact that a lot of the people coming into the country now are also soccer fanatics and used to supporting their local clubs. And when you move into an area, you want to play locally, you want to watch soccer locally. In our investment deck, the very first slide that we have is talking about the growth of the sport. Soccer is one of the fastest growing sports on the participatory side. But interestingly, it's also the fastest growing sport on the spectator side, according to a Gallup poll from a couple of years ago. And when you look at the sports that are really gaining momentum, and soccer is by far the fastest, but hockey and basketball are the other two that are also gaining popularity and gaining fans. And I think that's interesting because, you know, we're used to watching things all the time and we want to see movement, whereas some other sports where they're a little bit slower, a little bit more, you know, wine and cheese kind of sports are kind of losing momentum. So, people want to see action all the time. People want to see, you know, maybe some nuance, but they also want to be involved in the play. And I think that soccer allows them to do that, just given how accessible the sport is.
Absolutely. So, you know, I relate to Ira on the playing side. I grew up playing the game as well. I don't have any kids yet. Still feel too young for that. But definitely, grew up playing the beautiful game. With saying that, I just quickly want to go back to what Darren was saying, or actually ask you a question, Darren, quickly, in regards to when you say once in a lifetime, what does that mean? Are you saying once in a lifetime because of Copa America, the 2026 World Cup hosted by Canada, US, Mexico, and possibly a FIFA's Women's World Cup, and then we'll have Stephen come in right after.
100% what you just said, but marry that with this idea that it's being handed up. That doesn't last. That's a couple generations from going away. It won't continue to be handed up to vast majority of sports fans in the U.S. because I think it's Ira's kids as they age. Listen, they didn't have it handed up. They got it handed down. Good for you, Ira. By the way, I'm writing down wine and cheese sports, Ira, right here on my notes. I love that. But that's only a couple generations, three tops. And so that changes. Baseball's not being handed up. Basketball, American football, not being handed up. they're well established and they trickle down. I just think from a business standpoint, that's lightning in a bottle, and we're trying to make sure we're going to be good stewards of it.
Absolutely. If I can jump in here too, Kareem, I think the other opportunity to go along with what Darren said is just the professional landscape, like just geographically. There's, unlike minor league baseball, for example, that organically over 150 years, you know, built up this whole minor league system with smaller ballparks all over the place. We haven't had that same opportunity in soccer yet. So, you know, having a team in Statesboro, Georgia was, you know, not something that Major League Soccer was ever going to do, but there's still massive demand for spectator sport in these second tier markets. And so I think that when it comes to, you know, we all talk about, you know, will Sacramento be the next MLS team or whatever, regardless of that, there's still a lot of untapped territory all around the country where minor league soccer can really thrive in the country. And like Darren said, that's not going to last forever, right? We're on the leading edge of that. And that growth is only going to go so far and so fast. And right now we're kind of getting to that trajectory where it has started to take off, but now it can start to grow exponentially. And, you know, 2026 and 2027, if we have the Men's and Women's World Cup here, you know, that could really be the impetus to get the just acknowledgement by a broader fan base that we have local soccer in our areas, and everyone should be willing to take advantage of that.
100%. So really emphasizing to investors that this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. There's a lot of exciting events that are going to be happening in the U.S. There's opportunity. There's land opportunity. Territories still open, unlike the U.K., Stephen. But me and Stephen, we were just on a phone call, you know, talking about investments the other way. But Stephen, I'm really interested to hear your thoughts in regards to investment in the U.S.
Yeah, I think what the gentlemen were just both talking about is spot on. If you look at it, you know, I'm from England originally. We have the Premier League, which is the most successful league in the world. You know, the best players in the world, massive, massive clubs. It's a close, you know, it's not a close shop like MLS. There is pro rel, so you have the ability to kind of work your way through the pyramid. but I think the league that for me impresses me so much and really mirrors a lot of what Darren can do and Ira doing in Georgia and Central Jersey and so many other markets across the U.S., Albuquerque. The English Football League, which is 72 clubs, the oldest league in the world, the clubs aren't franchises. The clubs aren't businesses. They're community assets. So obviously, you have to operate them as a business. You want them to be financially sustainable. But they are community assets. The owners that operate those clubs consider themselves guardians. And their work is to try and provide opportunities for local players to have careers, for people to stay healthy. It's so many different layers of participation from both the fan standpoint and a player development standpoint at these clubs that's completely amazing. So and when I was at the Oakland Roots, we would quite often have people asking us, you know, as a USL championship club, you know, do you aspire to be in MLS? Is this your next step? And the reality is, we were very, very happy and content being a member of the USL Championship and trying to build a better mousetrap every single week, to be honest with you, right? How we can continue to fulfill our purpose as a purpose-driven organization in the Bay Area. So I think that's when you look at where the sport is going, you know, we're all having to tell the story on a regular basis. As I pointed out earlier, I feel the game is in a far better place than when I started working on the business side in 1993. There's more players, there's more leagues, there's more clubs. You know, the thing that I think blows my mind that it is so interesting to be able to share with people, and I really think 2026 is sport. We at For Soccer get more and more brands approaching us, trying to make those authentic connections with the soccer fans, with those consumers, ahead of that World Cup. You know, keep in mind, the last Super Bowl had 62.5 million global viewers. The 1.5 billion. So it's telling that story that America is the demographics of the country are changing at such a rapid pace. And I think that diversity aligns with the global sport, right? In terms of people that love the game, have a passion for the game in every single market of this country. So, you know, I remain more bullish about the game than I've ever been before. And as Darren was talking about in regards to participation and the age of that, you know, that same Gallup survey talked about the younger demo in that soccer is kicking baseball's butt in terms of interest from that younger demographic as well. And I think I've got two younger kids. They can't sit still for 5 minutes. So soccer is perfect for exactly kind of what that mindset looks like.
Absolutely. Diving into the league, Darren, what specific factors making an investment in the United Soccer League was particularly attractive compared to the other sports leagues? You know, you got the MLS Next Pro, there's NISA, but what really attracted you to invest in USL?
It was a pretty easy decision for me. Here's why I liked it. You know, I think a lot about organizational structures and government sort of thing is usually a good example. The USL for me was much more of a federal system where it had a strong center and it was composed of all kinds of parts. U.S. government would be a good example of that, right? What D.C. is a strong federal system. You get states on the sides. And every other league that I saw looked more like a confederacy to me, in that they were very weak centers. The league itself was weak. Teams were probably quite strong. The clubs were very strong. And that just wasn't a system that appealed to me. For me, confederacies don't last very long for a reason. And they tend to fall apart as soon as the members of confederacies don't want to be there anymore. And I needed, I believed, a strong center to grow this thing. And if we were going to be really, really strong, that would be it. I think that was the first piece that did it for me. There are more leagues now than when we first started in 2016, or 2015. But the other piece that appealed to me was to have so many different layers inside the USL, whether it was the pro side and the pre-professional. And I think we've only gotten better on the academy side. We've added a Super League now, and we don't have a Super League team, but we have a W League team. But we benefit by being inside of a league that does those things. USL right now is the only professional sports league in the world that has men and women pros under the same umbrella. There are lots of countries that have men and women sports, but they're not in the same league. And I think as we mature as a league, remember, we're still not that old either. And the last World Cup in the United States, there was no MLS or a USL. But as we mature and get smarter, and our owners get smarter, and quite frankly, as HQ gets smarter with us, I think we're making some. I think we have the opportunity to do some pretty fun things. We have the opportunity to stub our toes often, and we do. But I think as a group, by and large, the league has really created an ownership class where people really see themselves as being teammates with each other. Not on Saturdays when we're keeping score, but as teammates with each other. And I think that's a pretty healthy development to date.
For sure. Talk about stubbing toes. Actually, before our call, I stubbed my toe. It really hurt. You know, you also mentioned, you know, war on the pitch, we compete on the pitch, collaboration on the front office side of things. And I really want to highlight in regards to, you know, when I speak to people in Europe or, you know, people in the US as well, in regards to investments in the UK, you cannot start, a club from scratch. You got to invest in an existing one. When we talk about the US, there's opportunity to start your own club. So I think that's very exciting and very appealing to investors. Ira, I'm also interested to get your thoughts in regards to why USL was the lead that you were attracted to go to.
Yeah, well, we decided on USL League Two a few years ago when we first started the club as an adult amateur club, right? That was our foundation, working with our youth partners. So in New Jersey, there's a lot of fantastic developmental clubs, and we didn't want to compete with them or take anything away from them. So we'd rather work with them in order to develop players. We chose USL League Two because of the pathway to professional. You know, so the great thing about League Two is that there's a scouting network and there's the ability for players to get looked at by professional teams. You know, so players from my team might be able to play in Statesboro. We have a couple of players who play in USL right now. One of our players plays for USL Championship team Loudoun United, right? So we do have the appeal for USL was that pathway. So, you know, someone plays for Next Level Soccer or Match Fit Academy, they then play for us in our Academy League team and then our USL 2 team, and then from there hopefully they can play in the professional ranks if they're good enough. So that was the real appeal. You know, we did have other options, and I think some of those other options aren't necessarily bad. There's nothing wrong with the other pre-professional, amateur summer team options. But USL was there because it fit the mission, right? So our mission is to entertain, connect, and develop. And that development piece required us to have a direct kind of pre-professional to professional pathway. And USL has that designed in it. It sounds like a commercial for USL. It's not necessarily, right? We did consider other things, but these are the reasons why, you know, we at Real Central New Jersey chose USL at the time. And there was no W League at the time. So we committed for a number of years to a different league. So we don't know if we'll play in the W League or not in the future. But certainly now that it exists, it's possible that we will make that move at some point in the future.
For sure. Steven, correct me if I'm wrong, right or wrong. You've worked in the MLS and you've also worked in USL, correct?
Yes, correct.
So, without being biased here, what league have you had the best experience in? If you could say, if not, you know, what investment opportunity appeals attractive to you? Again, I do know that you're more so focused on Europe, but in regards to, you know, the US, what investment opportunity looks appealing to you and for investors to consider it?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different factors, and a lot of this becomes personal for investors across the board. Has gone from, you know, having, you know, the opportunity that existed to acquire franchises for 50 to 100 million to 500 million. So, you know, the MLS is starting to, not at that point yet, but mirror what the Premier League is, which is only the uber rich. It's sovereign states that are typically buying Premier League clubs at this point. So there's not lots of investment opportunities that exist at that level. The English Football League is much much older, obviously, more established, but much more similar to what USL is trying to do. Again, I think some of the similarities that are important are what I alluded to earlier. They are trying to build community assets. And if you look at the clubs, whether it be an MLS or across the USL, that have been most successful, they've been the ones that have had, I think, a real good long-term game plan. They've built a business plan that is understanding that they may incur some losses in the first couple of years, but they're trying to build a brand. They're trying to build a player development pathway that's going to be successful in the long term for the organization, rather than just coming out with a short-term mentality. I think some of this still exists more in Europe than over here, where you almost get the sense that the strategy is more of a flip than a long-term plan. That the mindset is they're going to go over there, figure out what's going wrong with the CFL club, throw a lot of money at it and fix it. And these two gentlemen on the line here, Ira and Darren, both know it's not that easy. It takes a lot more work and effort by people and a lot of boots on and engage with the community, engage with the youth and the adult and the corporate community and the politicians, both at local and regional level, to really align together with the same kind of purpose to be successful. So I think the both provide incredible opportunities. And I think some, like I said, it's personal in a large degree, right? That if you're in your hometown community and you believe in the sport and you think it's a community that can support it in the right way, whether that's in the UK or the US, that's, I am assuming, in most cases, the biggest determining factor.
Sorry for jumping in here, Kareem, but you know, one of the interesting things about, I think, the opportunity here in the U.S., and I had the opportunity to potentially buy a lower division or part of a lower division European club, but I decided instead to stay here and try to grow the game in the United States. If people are passionate about the game here and they think that within, say, I don't know about my lifetime necessarily, but my son's lifetime, my kid's lifetime, that the United States can win a World Cup, that needs to start here, right? Me going out and buying a third division club in the UK was probably not going to fulfill like the need to develop players in the US. But having more and more professional pathways, and Darren has a great infrastructure with his youth development, and he's eventually going to find some diamonds in the rough who are going to be able to play pro when they're 15 years old, and that's going to maybe lead them in order to go to bigger and better things. And when they're 18, they can go to Europe, right? So that's, those are the pathways that I think we need to be able to create here in a local community that you can't do in many locations just because we don't have the soccer infrastructure built yet. And so building out that soccer infrastructure takes a long time, takes a lot of capital, but it can have, in 5, 10, 15 years, massive dividends can be paid in doing that. And I think that's underappreciated by a lot of the people who are going and investing in European clubs. That's a business opportunity. This is not only a business opportunity here, which is, I think, a great business opportunity, but it's also a passion project and has to be a passion project for development of the game and the sport here in the U.S.
Kareem, I'm interested to see, and I'll ask Ira the question, this, is there anything he ever considered? There is multi-club models across the world at a much higher scale. I'd love to look into when you're going to start seeing, and I don't mean player sharing relationships, but a real pure multi-club model where Central Jersey is owned by the same group as, I don't know, Cheltenham Town in England or Barton in Scotland, where there is opportunities to what Ira was talking about, developing players, using a shop window to market them. There's work permit issues in some cases with moving players over there, but I think there's some opportunity there if it's the right clubs to achieve exactly what Ira just said, to provide opportunities to develop the best players. And yeah, we ideally want our best players to stay here. I've spent enough time with professionals to know that they all want to play at the very, very highest level. And I totally understand that. We don't have that yet. In time, that will happen. But we can provide the platforms to develop those players. And ideally, hey, listen, if half of the U.S. team was playing overseas and the U.S. won the World Cup, I'm not sure too many people would be critical of that situation.
Ira, did you want to touch on that?
Sure. Well, it's funny you mentioned that because we actually are in conversations with a fifth division club to have a partnership in the UK structure, right? So someone more or less at our level with USL2. I think that those relationships can be fostered. And you've already seen that in the USL, right? With some of the with some of the things that are going on out in California, right? With what you had with some of the USL championship clubs, you know, having partnerships with clubs in Scotland and, you know, partnerships with between some German clubs and some other USL League One clubs, right? So those types of relationships, I think, can be fostered. Whether or not there'll be cross ownership, I think that would be perfect, right? Like, you know, when you think about, you know, I know at least one USL championship club has an owner who also owns a lot of an EFL. I don't remember if they're League One or championship now, but an EFL club, right? A partial ownership. So I think that that's going to be coming more and more as the sport grows. And I would, you know, I always had hope that maybe some English investors who own successful European clubs would you know, come here and invest more in the United States. But you've certainly seen much more of the opposite, and that's I don't want to say disappointing, but because it certainly is bringing attention to the sport, right? The stuff that that Rob and Ryan are doing at Wrexham, for example, is not hurting the sport in the U.S. by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, in some ways, it might be helping because now people understand what is pro rel, right? Now you have a whole another class of people who are going to be talking about, you know, hey, we need pro rel in the U.S. And guess what? There's only one league that's likely to have pro rel or possibly will have pro rel at some point in the future, right? And it's not Major League Soccer. So there are a lot of interesting potential developments when it comes to that cross ownership. And I think that there's synergies too, right? Just things like scouting networks, right? If you have a partnership with, say, you know, a club in the Netherlands and a club in you know, lower divisions of England and then the US, you say, okay, look, we really need a really good number six, right, who tackles hard and stuff like that. And you talk to the coach there and say, well, hey, our number two, number six is really good, but he's not going to get a lot of playing time. Maybe we loan him to you, right? Like there can be a lot of synergies there, I think, in terms of you know, helping on both the technical side as well as marketing and player development and even loans, right? So even first team loans as well. I can envision that being something that starts to build as we have that lower division infrastructure more built out than we currently do today.
Got it. So,
Darren's had a championship team, so I'd be curious to hear what he has to say. Like, you know, one of his former players is playing in Major League Soccer now, and I'd be curious as to your thoughts on that, either multi-club ownership or some kind of partnerships with clubs elsewhere.
It's perfect. So I think it's way more underway than the panel seems to think it is. It's not necessarily quite as open as you might all know, but it's all happening. I think it started a lot at the academies before at the pro levels, and some of that was just symbolic, perhaps, and some of it was just ceremonial. But it's on an exponential rocket ship at the moment. And however we're talking about it now, even when you go publish this, it could be even a little bit different. It's fun stuff. I think because I kind of have this American baseball mindset that you have to have an organization that goes top to bottom. And I've often said if the Atlanta Braves or New York Yankees ever started figuring out that they need to go down to 2-year-olds instead of just starting with 18-year-olds, we have a whole different structure. I think this is where, you know, world football has always been ahead of the curve. We've tried to use some of those models in our own region. We do go down to 2-year-olds, but we're in a smaller market for sure. And listen, that's part of the fun. I like the grassroots part of what we're doing. And I think that's where my joy comes from.
Amazing. Top to bottom. I think, you know, Darren, when we talk about accessibility as well, just soccer is really easy to access. All we really need is a ball, right? A ball in a field and we're good to go. But you guys obviously provide more. I've listened to a lot of, Justin Papadakis. Am I saying that right? Please tell me I'm saying that right.
You're saying it right.
I got it. Okay. Thank you. I sometimes butcher it. But yeah, I've listened to a lot of Justin's interviews. And, you know, USL really focuses on real estate, right? The opportunity for a soccer asset to a soccer stadium to be an anchor and to develop other real estate around a stadium, that opportunity is there. And this is not a USL promotion by all means. We got two USL club owners here and Stephen Powell, who's been a part of USL and MLS. But going back to the real estate aspect of it, the opportunity is there. And it's a very huge opportunity. If we could just start with Darren and then go to Ira in regards to
that. I actually think on this one that soccer's late to the game on it. I think all the other major sports in the U.S. figured out. The Atlanta Braves, I'm in Georgia, so they're an easy example to use, but I could use a number of teams throughout the other sports. They don't move out of downtown Atlanta out to a different county because they thought the parking situation would be better. They moved because they didn't own the stadium. And now they don't just own the stadium. They own the hotel, the whole mixed-use piece, the shops. They lease the mall, all the apartments. And they've created a destination with Battery Atlanta. And the Braves are quite open. They make more money on the destination part than they do the ticket sales and the sponsorships and the concessions and the parking. And by the way, Major League Baseball is doing just fine on that piece. I just think there's a reality to all sports that if you're going to be involved in professional sports across the board in the United States, I can't speak to others with the same degree of input. I think when you've been around them much longer, it makes difference. But pro sports have to have something that cover them. You can't sell enough tickets. You have to sell tickets, by the way. But stadiums protect those things and the real estate around it's just easier. But that's a much bigger investment every time. I think that's a new logic, quite frankly, for soccer owners, but it's not, it's a relatively new subject. By relative, I mean the last 15, 20 years where the real estate around stadiums was being built. But even the oldest one in the country, Wrigley Field, now the Cubs own all the buildings in the outfield and they own four blocks behind home plate. I think it's just a protective piece that's there. But at the same time, how do you make sure it's that community asset that's along the way? And as salaries have skyrocketed in all sports, that's what's driven this need to move into the real estate piece of it. So I think Justin's accurate in talking about that, but the USL is just the latest sort of league to talk about that, because if you look at any new sports stadium being built in the United States, they all have the same logic, even the ones that are being built on university campuses sometimes. But remember, if they're on a university campus, they're already surrounded by live, work, eat, play, you know, kinds of notions.
And Darren, you guys have built your stadium, and you guys are also building other real estate around there as well.
Yeah, so we've had to use that model for us. I don't think it has to be everybody's only model. That's by any means would I ever say that some of the most successful clubs in our league are not real estate deals. But it's just a different way to pursue it. And for us, it's a way to provide protection to a club because, you know, you don't always go undefeated. It rains and you have challenges to the ways that pro sports teams or any level make money through concessions and parking and merchandise and sponsorship and tickets. So how do you provide protection to all those things on the downside? How do you make sure that your venues are being used over and over and over again? And that's how some folks are getting into the real estate notion. But it's going to look different in every club. And listen, in most cities, you've had to get the public sector involved in that to make it done. In our particular case, while we have rabid support from our public and our state and local officials, we've really had to do it all through private means.
Understood. Ira, I know you're in heading towards that direction. But for our viewers and our listeners, can you just paint a picture of where you are now and where you're heading?
Yeah, so New Jersey is the densest state in the country when it comes to population, right? So real estate here is always at a premium. I mean, not as much of a premium as say Manhattan, right? But real estate is at a premium. So you would have to, in almost any situation where you're going to build a soccer specific or even a multi-sport stadium, have at least some form of probably public interest, right? So the government would have to come in with something. Even if it's just infrastructure improvements or putting in a new traffic light at an intersection, right? That's the government's going to have to come in and do something in order to assist. So, we have several different paths that we're exploring right now, and part of that will depend on who comes in as our primary team owner and how much they want to spend. Because we have a potential for an option to lease a soccer specific stadium for a municipality, or potentially build out an entire entertainment kind of neighborhood or district right off of a major interstate highway. So those are, we have multiple different options. We worked with the consultants that USL have worked closely with a lot of USL clubs, and those consultants basically vetted a couple of different properties, and one of them is actually, it would be great. It was actually recently in the news about a fake rumor about something else that I won't get into, but the fact that we have these options is great. The big challenge is convincing people and some other people who aren't necessarily have soccer on their radar as an investment opportunity to come in and be an investor. And we're not the only club that's in that situation. There's seven or eight other clubs that are looking to join USL at either the Championship or League One level that are also looking for primary team owners like we are, and if suddenly 10 people popped up and they were willing to invest a substantial amount of money, we'd be able to build out USL League One in a hurry for sure. There's a lot of people aren't as foresightful as Darren is, you have to again convince them, right? Because they're not necessarily soccer people, or if they are soccer people, they don't think about soccer as an investment, because it's not a .com kind of investment, right? You're not gonna make 1,000x on this kind of investment, but it can generate value insofar as, like Darren said, if you own your infrastructure, if you own your stadium, if you have, in our case, men's and women's games, that's 30 dates a year. There's a lot of other dates then that you can rent out the stadium for concerts or to other sports, other field sports like lacrosse, for example, or even other soccer related events like high school sports and even college sports. So there's a lot of utility that you can get out of a modestly sized stadium of 5,000 seats instead of a 30,000 seat stadium that is going to be too expensive to operate for a college soccer game, for example.
Yeah, I respond on one last comment, and Stephen can make us smarter on this one too. Part of the problem on the real estate issue, even though the formula and the math might be right, that's incredibly expensive. That's incredibly expensive, and some of it just have luck. You got to have access to land, and that's the really, really hard part. And the location, is, again, I just say this. Listen, I use an example for Major League Baseball. I'm just convinced about this, and this is why the USL makes sense to us, to me, I should say, and some of the other leagues could make sense for the similar reason. But just because you're in larger cities with, billion-dollar stadiums, doesn't mean that smaller areas, that people in smaller areas aren't less sophisticated. People are still plenty sophisticated. It's just a different scale. But the formula is still a good formula. But what's the scale? I mean, we don't need a bigger stadium for where we play more than 5,500. We just don't need it. That's the right size. Let's have lines and people can be on waiting lists. It's just that's not a big demand. Other leagues need to fill 40, 50, 60, 70,000 seat stadiums. Great. I like those leagues too, but that's just not the business that we're in. And because of that, we just get you, whatever you need to do. However, it's no different than the stock portfolio. However long, well, you can diversify it. Real estate's just one of them. And that happens to be the way we're doing. And Ira, what a great reminder that was. I was saying we were doing all things private, but oh my God, did we need governments to pave roads and put up streetlights and have buses come our way and all of that. So don't misunderstand my point.
Amazing.
Yeah, I'm hoping going forward in the future with the sport that more municipalities, states are going to see a bigger picture, be a bit more supportive of different projects. You know, I was part of the Quakes when, same situation Ira was saying, you know, very dense community, very, very expensive real estate. You know, we weren't able to get that kind of support. We couldn't identify property. We weren't able to secure any support publicly. That team landed up moving to Houston. You know, interestingly enough, we moved to Houston. And even in Houston, it took us a while to figure out a way of, you know, how do we fund this? How do we build this stadium? And it was the first downtown stadium in the U.S. in MLS. Columbus had already been built, but wasn't in a downtown location. And that was built without public dollars. It was built with a funding mechanism called TERS funding, which is basically as the property values increase, those increased taxes are used to pay that back. So, you know, it was all privately financed, the construction. There was some infrastructure support and help around it, but it wasn't massive. The whole project was less than $90 million. And you look at what those projects look like now, it's more than twice that. And that isn't just based on increases in steel and other materials. It's just the cost of doing business has increased, you know, across the board. And you know, just exactly what Darren said in terms of the size of the stadium, I've had conversations with people here in the States that have asked about, you know, what I would do in terms of stadium capacity, because, you know, they're talking about building a 10 and 20,000 seat stadium because they're confident they can fill it. You know, with what you can build today with modular stadiums, you don't have to worry about brick and mortar restrictions. You could build that 5,000 seat stadium, build a business, and really, really drive that demand and expand the building based on the demand, based on the needs, without, you know, incurring, you know, a massive upfront capital cost in terms of construction. So I think we're finding better and better ways to build a football club, a business here in the U.S. And there's just so many good examples at every level of USL and other leagues that are doing it right.
For sure. I want to be respectful of everyone's time here. So I'll ask this last question. You know, on my last call too, just, you know, an hour ago, women's soccer is a big topic. Equality, opportunity. USL, you know, this goes back to Darren's point, USL Super League is under the same ecosystem for USL. They recently just had an announcement in regards to USL being Super League being sanctioned as a Division I women's professional league. What is everyone's perspective on the opportunity to invest in USL Super League and just, you know, in women's sports and in women's soccer? And whoever wants to take that one first could just pop in.
I guess I'll take that first. I mean, we started our club and we were always intent on equity, right? On having both a men's and women's program, and we run them the same. I mean, they have different coaches, right? They have different things like that, but the game day experience is identical. The staff is identical. We, you know, we share revenue from sponsors. We do all of that. So it was very important for us to make sure that we had our men's and women's teams. And in fact, our first two seasons, our women's team had more, had a bigger gate than our men's team. And at least in terms of average attendance, that equaled out a little bit last year with our change in venue. But the, I think that that's very important. And you see more and more women going to games, right? And just the fact that you have in the U.S., the U.S. women's national team obviously has historically been the best team in the world for basically two generations now. Ups and downs, obviously, but generally speaking, it's one of the strongest teams, and so it gets a lot of attention. And I think that helps the sport on the spectator side. And when you look at the young women who play the sport and who's coming up behind them, you know, they're just really passionate. They love the game, and there's there's just a lot of passion there for them to come to matches. So we have when we sell our season tickets, we have season tickets, we have men's only and women's only. We sell about an equal number of men's and women's season tickets only. And, you know, mostly it's by the parents of the players and their friends. But then when you look at the individual tickets and who shows up, we do have about 50% crossover. So about 50% of the people come in the gate, come to all the soccer games. They just like soccer. They're soccer fans. And then there's people who only come to women's games and some who only come to men's games. But there is this big middle ground where people just love soccer, right? It's the same reason, you know, I used to go to Red Bulls games and Gotham FC games. And, you know, back then it was Sky Blue. But, there's just because you love the game and you want to see the game at different levels, you want to see different players, you want to see different styles of play and all of those things. And so I think it's important to be equitable. And I think that that's really a potentially massive growth area in the country. And again, from a real estate perspective and from someone who, hopes to build a stadium, just the utility and having 30 home games in that stadium instead of only 15, like that's helpful from a revenue perspective, from selling sponsorships, right? There's a lot of, I think, positives that can come from offering both products from both a fan engagement and as well as a corporate partnership perspective.
Got it. Europe has definitely taken off with the women's sport, and it's growing in the U.S. A bit slow here in Canada, but it's the same game being played on the field, but it looks a bit different. And we're seeing fans really engage with the women's sport now, and it's really exciting. I watch it myself too. I see it on TV, and I get excited as much as I get excited watching Major League Soccer. We'll have Stephen come in here, and then we'll end off with Darren.
Yeah, Kareem. I think I feel for a lot of the women athletes, to be honest with you, because it is a different game. They are world class athletes across the board. They have been. I look at the U.S. women's national team. I remember, I think it was 1997 or 98. We had the U.S. women's team before the MLS All-Star game. It was played at the Citrus Bowl in Orlando. And I was so impressed with how the women, the team members presented themselves, engaged with the supporters, engaged with the fans. And I don't think that's changed. I think that a lot of the NWSL players, they're passionate about the game. It's played at a very, very high level. Yes, the Super League in England is now starting to attract a lot of those great American players. I think that's the challenge NWSL is going to have, how they retain the best U.S. talent in this country. But I know there's been some criticism and discussions around there being two D1 sanctioned pro women's leagues. I don't think that's a problem. I just think providing more opportunities for these terrific athletes to show what they can do across the board. I think it provides a lot of aspiration for the young women that want to play professional soccer to go out and see that and do it across the entire board. I was with the Dynamo when we were the second club to have a NWSL team. We had the Dash. Our crossover wasn't as high as Iris. Ours was about 30%. 35%. And in Oakland, I think it was about 40% the audience was shared. But to me, that also is exciting because I think that means you're able to continue to expand an audience. Yes, you can cost promote, but you can continue to expand and have a bigger audience. and hopefully try and get more people from that follow each of the clubs to give the other one a try and continue.
That's it all. Thanks for giving me the one last shot at it, Corinne. This is a lot of fun, very helpful. It's fun to talk to soccer folks, much less smart people. We're pretty bullish on the women's side. I'm not sure we're the right market for Super League. I think there are far larger cities that need to go first. And let me just do the math in terms of what Steve was talking about. We've got over 100 professional men's team in the United States. Right now, we just added 8 in the Super League in the USL to the 12 that existed in the NWSL. There's 20 pro teams. Just do the math. 20 times 25, that's a large roster. For the has to be 100,000 women playing in the colleges and just high schools alone. So the math is way off. And the irony is, at the national level, at the highest level, the women in the United States are certainly outperforming. So I think more soccer is really, really good. But it means a lot to me to be in a league that has professional women's soccer. We have a W League team, won a title with that the first year. That's meaningful to us. And in just 2 years, we've signed 15 to contracts. Every one of them had to go to Europe because there are no opportunities to sign in the U.S. There is no Division II women. There is no Division III. So there's just some massive ironies in play here. But when you have half the population, I do think it catches up, but the opportunities, while good, are different. I want to make one last point. I think this is where I give the Amanda Vandevort and the league real credit. I want you to think about this. So the Super League's going on the global calendar. That's a big difference because there are no national team players in the U.S. who play in the USL. There's plenty of other countries. We have 3 who are about to be called up to international duty right now from Tormenta. So we have plenty of national team players in our leagues. But we don't have any men's national teams at the U.S. level. The women, however, are about to have an opportunity to play in a league that's domestic that fits the global calendar. Stay tuned. Stay tuned to see, I think, how many of them are going to find a league that jumps that a little bit differently. You know, I think about the recent owners that have, who are more celebrity status, even bigger than Ira Jersey, believe it or not, on the celebrity side, who have joined the league, and everybody from Tim Tebow and Dominique Wilkins and Marshawn Lynch. And listen, even if some of them are more symbolic, like, Peter Wentz and Didier Drogba and, Tim Howard, but those are celebrities on the men's side. You wait till but those are owners. Wait till the celebrities on the women's side start playing, and I think you have a league inside of a Super League that's inside of that USL ecosystem. There's another rocket ship worth watching, and I just really keep our eyes on that and that reality alone. I think you're muted, Kareem. Just to tell you,
I was talking like I was unmuted. Thanks, Darren. I mean, so I'm going to quote Darren here. Once in a lifetime opportunity to invest in U.S. soccer. I'm going to quote Matt Reddick here from USL Expansion Team. There's a lot of juice in the orange to squeeze in the U.S. And this was really fun, guys. I really appreciate everyone for taking the time. This was my first panel for One Soccer Nation. It was amazing, and I hope you guys enjoyed it. And again, I just want to thank everyone for taking the time to be on the One Soccer Nation panel today.